we've been watching all of this new tech and tools for years now, but we've always said, like, we're not going to jump in the deep end until we feel like the outputs are good enough that we would be proud to stand behind it as a brand. And I think that's starting to happen.
That's TJ Leonard, CEO of Storyblocks, and someone who's had a front row seat to one of the biggest shifts happening in content today. How AI is reshaping the entire creative ecosystem.
Everyone is feeling a certain amount of excitement because there is this like new thing, and I think we're seeing it progress and it feels real. But at the same time, I don't think anyone can tell you what the end game is. So there's also this element of uncertainty.
Because AI isn't just changing how content gets made. It's changing customer expectations, how teams collaborate, and what good even means.
I'm a big believer that like anytime something really new is happening, you must be present to win. And I'm speaking kind of specifically to generative here. Go try these things. Go get hands-on. Go play with them. Make time to tinker.
In this episode, we dig into how AI is reshaping creative work, the uncertainty, the opportunity, what creators need now, how teams can adapt, and where all of this is heading. I'm Chris Savage, CEO and co-founder here at Wistia, and this is Talking Too Loud. TJ, it's been a while. How are you?
Chris, I am great. It's good to see you. I think the last time we caught up, if memory serves correct, we were walking laps around your office on one of my trips to Boston a couple of years ago. So it's good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too. I love doing that. I love walking laps.
Were you racing? Or was it just like a casual stroll?
We were moving. It was the summer. We migrated inside when the pace got the better of us. But no, I'm a walker and a talker too. Normally I've got a standing desk. I'm a little too fidgety to just sit all day. So
yeah, I think people undervalue the walking meeting. And well, if you're trying to have a hard conversation with somebody, not that our conversation was hard, it was not, but if you are, it's much easier to have it when you're walking. Have you heard this?
I have not.
I've never heard this.
Really? This is like a secret. This is like if you need to have a hard conversation with somebody and you take them on a walk, it's much easier for a bunch of reasons. It's easier because like often you're not looking directly eye to eye. That's one thing that makes it easier. But also, I saw this study once that there's a million studies going around all the time and like what's real, what's not, I don't know. But when you are out walking, your brain is scanning for threats as like just like a human instinct thing. And so the limbic system is not responding in the same way to the news of what you're hearing.
So you're almost fight or flight is already activated.
Correct.
So you're like deflecting the defensiveness that the hard conversation might engender.
Exactly. And I think
I'm going to fact check this, just FYI.
Yeah, no, fact check it. We'll go in the fact check section at the end. We could go on and on and on, but I'm going to rein us in. And I do want to know what has you talking too loud. Like, you know what we're doing here today. Like, is there anything that popped to mind that's like, oh, yes, this is the thing I'm pumped on?
You know, and I know we're going to get into plenty of things that have me and Storyblocks excited, but I have to admit, personally, I'm a music fan. So I love seeing live music. I will still never forget that like first concert you went to after the pandemic when you're like, this is what it feels like to be a human being. Good. And I went to UVA, so we're not too far from Charlottesville here in DC. So I have one of my favorite musicians, Billy Strings, bluegrass artist, is playing at UVA for the first time next spring. And tickets went on sale just before I hopped on with you, and I was able to snag a few.
Oh, congrats.
Let's go. Yeah. So that's great.
So life is good, and it also allows you to get the text chain going, rally the crew. So I'm a big fan of always having something on the calendar out in the future to look forward to. So I feel like I added a big one for spring 26.
That's awesome. I love that too. I love having something to look forward to. Okay, well, look, let's jump into the moment we're in today. And you are watching creative teams and really like tech and AI and customer expectations, like I would say collide in real time. Yeah. So what I'm interested in is, What's something you're seeing right now that most people haven't realized yet about this like AI wave that's occurring?
Yeah, I think a lot of times like the wave is so big that it can feel overwhelming. And sometimes it feels like there's this one big thing that's happening to all of us. And I actually think there are a bunch of things that are all connected that are happening at the same time. So, you know, I think about like technology cycles in general, which we're definitely living through. And usually when a new technology comes about, like in the beginning, like the technology is the star and it's, and it has this toy-like quality and we want to play with it and we want to understand what it can do. But oftentimes it's like kind of divorced from the customer and like, is this useful to my customers? And so I think one element of the moment we're living for is we're actually like at this pivot point where we're transitioning from the technology is the star of the show to like, okay, that's right. We have customers, technology serves customers.
Yeah.
How might we apply this new technology to come up with a novel solution to serve an established customer need? So I think that's like one really interesting moment. I think also, and I'm speaking kind of specifically to generative here, we're also going from like the proof of concept phase into like the value creation where there's more utility. So for us, we've been watching all of this new tech and tools for years now, but we've always said like, we're not going to jump in the deep end until we feel like the outputs are good enough that we would be proud to stand behind it as a brand. And I think that's starting to happen like with more and more use cases.
Can you tell people what Storyblocks does so they understand? Because what you said to me, I know all about you and I know everything. So I understand this, what that actually means. But for people who don't know, what is Storyblocks and why is that such a, why does that matter so much?
Good to start at the beginning. So we're a video creation platform. We've got a stock media library, about 6 million high quality assets. We focus on video and music. We have an exclusive music library, our own label. So it's really all of the content that you would need as a video creator to go put a project out there. And then we pair it with tools that generally make the creative process easier, more efficient. And the whole idea is, look, the biggest challenge facing creative teams today, this was true when we started Storyblocks, it's even more true now, but the biggest challenge is keeping up. It's producing enough high quality content to meet the demands of your customers. So we've always been about not just having great stuff, but putting it together again with simple workflow solutions that help you scale your production process.
And it's not like, so you have stock footage, you have music, none of it is AI, all of it is high quality, all of it is created by humans. And that has been your value prop. And so when you talk about only really jumping into the generative world when it's good enough, it's like the bar is very high, right? Like someone knows if they go to Storyblocks, they're getting really, really great stuff.
That's right.
So, right.
We've sort of taken a stand. We've said, you know, it's incredibly confusing for customers to try and figure out what is properly licensed, what is created by humans, what is authentic content versus what is generative. So we said, you know what? Come to Storyblocks, and one thing you can know for certain is everything in our library is made by humans. And at the same time, like there's a lot of value that's getting created through these tools. And so our approach has been, you know, it feels strange that we would have this amazing new technology and its sole purpose would be to replace human creativity. So wouldn't it be nice if you could pair this wonderful, authentic library with these new tools to really address like the limitations of stock media, which there are, right? Like I joke with the team, what's the biggest weakness of stock media? It's that it's stock media. It doesn't feel customized. It doesn't feel unique to your brand. So what if we could pair this library with these tools to give, you know, kind of the ultimate creative control to creators so that you can customize. It makes it easier to pair one asset with another so that the project feels seamless. So yeah, so that's been how we've approached it. Again, this doesn't have to be a replacement for what we've been building the last decade plus, but it can turn, you know, a beautiful, highly curated library of, you know, a few million assets into kind of an infinite number of creative possibilities, this kind of endless aisle of content.
Got it. So you're basically saying, and you feel like it's getting good enough now, the generative video stuff is getting good enough now that you can actually confidently start to apply it to the library.
Yes. You know, in pockets, right? Like, I think there is still, you know, I remember this with mobile. You know, years ago, I worked in Boston, not too far from the Wistia offices, for a voice recognition business. And the promise when technology came out was just like, talk to your phone and it'll do whatever you want, right? Yeah. Like in 2009, this was a wild concept. And in the beginning, it didn't, the technology was good, but it didn't really meet that ultimate promise. And so you build some guardrails, and over time, the technology catches up to the promise. And now we're all very used to using voice as an input. And it's sort of the same thing here. You know, there are use cases where it works really well, and there are places where the models get tripped up. And again, that's kind of how we see our role. We're not like a true marketplace in the sense that we'll just let anything in the door and the customers can vote on what's valuable. We do some curation up front. We kind of feel like we need that curator's role with generative as well. Like, we'll do the hard work of sifting through the models and figuring out which use cases are production ready. And only then would we bring it onto the platform.
Got it. So in terms of applying the stuff, like, what are you seeing are there any disconnects between the creators who are making the content and the customers that they're making this content for? Like, what do you think is causing frustration? What do you think is getting people excited right now?
You know, I think everyone is feeling a certain amount of excitement because there is this like new thing. And I think we're seeing it progress and it feels real. But at the same time, I don't think anyone can tell you what the end game is. So there's also this element of uncertainty. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of customers, like, everyone believes this will unlock a great deal of efficiency. So we did this with our own creative team. You know, they came and we sat down, we're doing our creative planning, and they're like, hey, we can do this many things, you know, in the next quarter, in the next year. And we were like, okay, cool. But what if you use this tool to help with like cut downs for social? What if you used this tool to help, you know, edit our copy? What if we used this tool? And so I think the expectation is already there that to start using some of these tools to drive more output. So I think there's an even greater expectation on creative teams from customers to produce more. And at the same time, like, we're hearing a lot of creative teams, like, there's excitement, but there's uncertainty. Again, they don't know the end game. And they don't want to lose like the soul of storytelling. So I think there's a lot of tension for sure. But anytime, you know, you're a founder, so you know that like excitement and uncertainty like are often mixed in the same.
They go hand in hand.
They go hand in hand. They're not opposites. They are.
It's a signal of the opportunity usually, right?
100%. Were you afraid of the dark as a kid? Anything like that?
A little bit. Yeah, I can definitely remember walking upstairs to my parents' house with all the lights off, and I couldn't ask Siri to turn them on, and it was being very, I would run into my room and get something and run back out.
Totally, hide under the covers, whatever. But if you were, at least for me, if I was like struggling to go to sleep, and I was like, is there something in the closet? Is there something in the bed? Like, what do? You like muster the courage and you like go peek under the bed, and there's like nothing there but a couple of, you know, a tennis ball. And you're like, okay, I'm cool. And we've been encouraging like our team to do the same thing. Like, just go look under the bed. Like, there's no boogeyman here. Like, go try these things. Go get hands on. Go play with them. Make time to tinker. Because I think once we all kind of have that like light bulb moment when you're like, I wonder if I could do this. And then you just kind of go figure it out. And you're like, wow, that was really cool. And, you know, that feeling of uncertainty transitions from, you know, something that engenders fear to something, again, to your point, Chris, it's like, oh, okay, this is an opportunity. This is like, I kind of have like a new superpower here. I wonder what I can figure out next.
But yeah, I do think there's a big mentality shift for people. And I think there's a lot of uncomfortableness occurring. And I think about it as like 2010s, tech seemed like up and coming, exciting. You could make a bunch of money and also stable. Like, a lot of these tech companies, you get in them, really consistent, very stable. Unless you were like a pretty, like probably less than 20 person startup, you didn't feel like you're risking everything
right.
to go be in a tech company, right? And actually get there and you're like, what are the levels? How do I grow? What's the path? Like, when do promotions happen? Like, you know, all these kind of, there was a lot of conversation around perks,
yeah.
you know, in the late 2010s. I'm like, which perks, which place? Like, let me pick. Like, oh, I like free lunches. I like whatever. And then COVID happened. Everyone goes remote. It's like, oh, wow, it's even more flexible. This is so great. It's like all about this, like, employee experience being amazing. And then now this, like, mass uncertainty, also yep. mass opportunity. And, like, should I even try a thing that will disrupt what I'm doing?
Yep.
Yeah, it's basically makes all companies have the potential to be like a 20-person startup.
It's so interesting you say that. It was one of the things I wanted to ask you. Like, Wistia's, you've been around for a little while. You're out of the woods. You've done the 0-to-1 thing. You're in growth. You're in scale mode.
Yeah.
And there's like a certain set of like behaviors, personalities that are attracted to a business at that stage as opposed yeah. to a 20-person startup. Like, do you find yourself pushing the team to embrace more of that 20-person mentality?
Yeah. And I think it's happened. I mean, Sylvia and I were just talking about this the other day. She's like, Savage is crazy here right now. Right?
Yeah. And it felt very like chaotic and frenetic and energizing. Like, feels good, but I can totally see friction.
Yeah. And it's also pretty different than when we started working together.
Yeah, very different.
And I think for us, it's been an evolution of like, hey, we think this AI thing is going to happen. We think it's coming, but we don't know where it's useful. And so there was a lot of confusion in the messaging for a while because it was like, are you telling me to use this thing that's bad? Or are you telling me that the quality bar is lowered for Wistia and all these things?
Yeah.
And I think it took a while to get the nuance right of like, no, we don't want the quality bar to lower, but we do want to see more potential for like trying things and failure. But we actually think we can get to lots of places faster. We could do things we couldn't do otherwise. And then what's happened is a lot of it's been about speed for us.
Yep.
And we had some massive advances in how fast we were going pre-AI, like tremendous changes. And they were all due to cultural changes that we made. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think being around for a long time, having a way of working that we thought was really good, and we had been making some mistakes. And it had been causing us to centralize too much of planning. It had been causing us to value having a great plan that was well-researched and backed up over like trusting the person's who was making the plan and their instincts on certain things and saying like, hey, you might have this thing that looks pretty small that your instinct on talking to 10 customers, it's going to have a big impact. You can't really research it. You could do it in 2 weeks. Like, you should do that versus in our old world, it wouldn't happen. And then the AI stuff started to happen. And that was a further acceleration of the speed. And it does feel, to Wistia today, feels much more like Wistia of almost exactly like 30 people, I would say, than it ever has. Like, it to me, it feels like it's completely early stage again.
It's so funny because we're a remote business, but we get the whole company together twice a year. We're based in DC, so we do DC in the spring, and then we kind of rotate a fun city in the fall. And we were just in Nashville.
How fun.
A ton of fun. And, you know, that was actually at one point we were talking about like long-term vision and how AI fits in and all that stuff. And I actually stopped in the middle. I was like, quick show of hands, like, who's ever worked for a 30-person startup? And, you know, like,
oh, really?
Half the team raises their hand. And I'm like, relate that experience to like everything we're talking about right now. And I'm like, yeah, it does kind of feel the same. Like, and it does. It is sort of, I don't know if you call it an identity crisis or like meeting the moment, but I think a lot of businesses are sort of forced to acknowledge that like, hey, the stuff that was working pretty well, you know, 2-3 years ago, like, is not going to work as well right now for all of these reasons. And so what does it mean to be more in that 30-person mode? You know, I'm a big believer that like anytime something really new is happening, like, you must be present to win.
Yes.
And I think a lot of times, you know, there is this quality bar, you hesitate, you're like, it's not good enough, it's not ready. But I think right now you have to assume that eventually and probably soon it will be good enough. And so you've got a choice. You can like wait, in which case like you'll be behind.
Yeah.
Or you can like suffer a little in the short run to kind of build that institutional knowledge, to build the understanding,
yes,
so that when it does cross that magical threshold and it's like, oh, it is good enough, like you're already there. And again, you're delivering value to your customers faster than anyone else.
Yeah. And it seems to me that there's like a mentality thing that in a small business or a startup, everyone ends up with it because there's uncertainty everywhere. You don't know what's going to happen in a 20-person company. Like, you got very little revenue. Like, the revenue you have probably is all-time high all the time, hopefully. Yeah. But like, if you were to look back 2 years ago, it might be hard to imagine where you are. And also looking 2 years in the future is hard to imagine. And so everyone's used to this uncertainty. Then as companies and organizations get bigger, a lot of the macro level uncertainty goes away. And the uncertainty might be about like little things that you're doing in your part of the business. But I think one thing that maybe was not always obvious is like, if you're the CEO or you're a really senior person, a lot of the uncertainty stayed. Yeah. Because you don't know, just like in the early days, like what will happen in 2 years? Well, if a bunch of these projects work, it's gonna be really great. And if a bunch of them don't work, it's not gonna be great. And like, you're still in that mode of managing the uncertainty. It's just a larger scale.
Sure.
And I feel like that's part of the reason why in this moment, we've had a lot of senior leaders who are like, hell yeah, let's go. And their team's are like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Because from the uncertainty perspective, you can see it, it fits in. But if everyone hasn't been in that mode, if culturally you aren't ready for it, it feels very, very jarring. And a lot of what it seems like the last few years has been is everyone who is trying to make these changes, basically getting people comfortable culturally with like, hey, is this normal? Is this good? Like when Sylvie talks about being like chaotic and frenetic, but also exciting and energizing, lots of working, is this what normal is now? And then it's like, yeah, it probably is. It's like, okay, so then what should we do? We're like, well, we actually have to get better at saying no to stuff.
Right.
And we have to get better at trusting our instincts when something starts to work so we can keep it working and take it really far. And that's like harder to imagine. And so, yeah, I find this whole topic very interesting because collectively as a society going through this.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's not very often that something like that happens, that we all are experiencing the same thing in the same moment. Our mentality is being tested. And ultimately, it actually goes back to what you said before, which is what I want to go further into, which is just like, can we actually deliver the right things for customers or not? Like, that's basically the question.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I think that is the one, I appreciate the team at Storybox because the one thing we never lost track of was the customer. We never started to go chase the shiny toy. And, you know, I think this is true for creative teams. And I think it's certainly true for businesses. Like when you get like one of these moments where there's a step function change in how fast you can go, having a really clear-eyed view about the destination, about the vision, about your purpose is even more important because, you know, otherwise you're in a hurry to get nowhere in particular. And, you know, at least at Storybox, the way, you know, we've had to change the way we think about planning, you know, we try to give teams a lot of autonomy and we'll say like, hey, here's some customer problems that we need to go solve. Like, you tell me what we should build in order to solve these problems. And we started hearing, you know, over the course of the last 12 months, you know, it wasn't said this directly, but the way I interpreted it was, hey, the way we've gone about setting vision and direction, like, isn't good enough anymore. Like, as the like aperture of what's possible expands, like, we need better guardrails. Otherwise, like, we're going to get lost in space. And so, that's where we've put a lot of our energy, at least, is like, okay, all right, this is a big, brave new world. It's kind of an infinite number of directions we could pursue. Like, let's get really specific about, okay, how does this stuff interact with our library? What's the role of the library in the future? Like, what stuff's inbounds, what stuff's out of bounds in terms of tools we may consider adding to the platform? So, you know, I think that's one way we've tried to go about addressing it is, again, the team will tell you what they need, which is great. And it does feel like a moment where as leaders, you're having to adapt the approach a little bit, again, to make sure that you're closely aligned on exactly what value we want to pursue on behalf of our customers.
I think that's a really smart and strategic approach. Like, as much as like teams have to adapt and change to this moment, like the way that leadership is like communicating their expectations and their vision, that also has to adapt. Like, and if they don't happen in tandem, kind of what you said, like, then you're lost in space, or you really start to feel it.
Totally. Totally. And I think the same thing is true for, again, for creative teams. Like, you can pump out a ton of content right now. And again, if your creative teams don't have a really close connection to the business, I think creative teams probably will become more interdisciplinary in the future. You know, it's you know, kind of the legacy model, if you will, is like a collection of specialized experts who are really good at like this thing or that thing or the other thing. And it does feel like it's becoming more interdisciplinary. It feels like, again, having a real clear, you know, if everyone in your organization can articulate, like, why are we building this thing for our customer? How will their lives get better when we deliver it? Like, that's incredibly powerful. Then it starts to get reflected in the content that you're putting out there. And I think that's the recipe that, where the ability to produce more gets really exciting. To your point, Chris, like, the truth of the matter is you never know what's going to work. That's why you work on a bunch of things at once. And then when you find something that sticks, like, okay, great, like, we're doubling down here and pushing hard. And I think the same thing is very much true with creative. You got to know what you stand for. But there's a lot of ways to tell that story. Yeah. And again, you don't always know which one will resonate. And it feels like we're moving into one of these moments where it's like, okay, I've got sort of unlocked all of this new capacity. I can try a few different things. I can put them out there. I can see how our customers respond. And then when you find a note that strikes a chord, then like, okay, great. Let's push hard in that direction.
Yeah, I think I agree. And I think a lot of this, you know, for a long time, the limiting factor was the creating the content, creating the products, right? And that's shifting away, where you will be able to create the content fast. You will be able to make the products. And then it's like, well, then the question is probably like, which of the things that you are making are working? Which of the things that are working align with like something that makes sense for you to be doing long term, because it's like strategically useful? Yeah. Which of the things do you actually want to maintain? You know, I think it's so interesting, because basically anyone can vibe code anything now.
Right.
Like, the vibe coding tools are incredible, but maintaining a thing that's being used by lots of people, pretty hard.
Yeah.
And so what is the value of vibe code? And a lot of it's like an expression of an idea, I think, where you can have an idea for something, you want to convince others that it's useful. And in an old world, you'd be convincing them of the value of this thing. And it's like, hey, let me convince you. Let's spend 3 months building this thing, or you're building this thing. This is why I think it's going to be so valuable. Well, now you could probably take a week or less, a day, and make something that's kind of close to what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But is it actually good? And how can you tell if it's good? And if it's, how can you tell if it's worth it to keep going, is a really interesting thing. I actually want to ask you something about this that I've been thinking about that's like a little bit different too, which is when you rely on AI to help in the production, whether it's like an idea, product, content. I've noticed the thing where I'll get an idea from AI. I'm like, oh, that's a cool idea. And try it on somebody else. Like, what do you think of this idea? Is this cool? And they're like, yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm like, yeah, okay. And then it's like, should we do it? I don't know. And I've noticed that if I came up with that idea, and usually I wouldn't pitch someone unless I really believed in it.
Sure.
And then I might pitch them on it. And if they weren't convinced, I might keep trying to convince them. And I might try to convince somebody else. And what if some of the ideas I'm getting from AI are actually quite good, but because I didn't create them, I don't believe in them. And then they don't happen anyway. You know what I mean? It's like an interesting thing when you think about how we use these tools. Do you have any sense of this? Any similar around all of this?
Yeah, for sure. It's like, it's this notion of commitment, right? Like, once you become fully committed to a thing, it's why we talk all the time about like disagree and commit. Like, great, we want to have the debate, but like when it comes time to move forward, like we want like real commitment. We want real buy-in, not just like passive acceptance and the willingness to execute.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing some of that reflected in what you're saying, Chris. It's like, oh, it's like there are constantly these like sprouts of ideas that are now popping up from all of these tools. You're not like, they come to you faster. And so, you know, the act of working through them and shaping them and reshaping them, like you're building your own self-belief, your own commitment in the idea as you work through that process. And so if the process changes, like, yeah, it would make sense that like you've got something that feels like fully formed in a traditional sense, but like you haven't gone through the same process and you don't have the same conviction behind it.
Yeah, because this part's so interesting because like basically what I think we're saying is like, if you don't have the commitment to an idea, you're probably not going to see it through such that it can actually get like a really great result. You know what I mean? Like,
I know just what you mean. And it's funny, I'm thinking back to like Nashville when we were like, raise your hand if you work for a 30-person startup. Yeah. And Sylvia were saying like, everyone's like, okay, well, like, what am I supposed to do now? How do I behave differently? And so we've had that conversation in, you know, multiple functions. And I was sitting down with our a UX researcher who's terrific and has been with us for a long time. And we were just kind of knocking back and forth, like, all right, how might like the voice of the customer, would the role of the voice of the customer change? And to your point, Chris, like, I think the way we used to do things is like, I've got an idea. And then we'd say, all right, maybe it's a good idea. Maybe it's a bad idea. Let's go talk to customers. And like,
yeah.
You know, you'd build some simple prototypes or you'd have them fill out a survey or you'd do some sort of qualitative interview and like you do that enough and like, oh, okay, that's like one way you would go about building that conviction. And I think like now we were talking about like maybe a lot of our calories need to shift, not from like pre-release research, but post-release research.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's okay that you don't, you know, have as much conviction around the idea when you ship it because it's a lot easier to ship it.
Yeah.
And, you know, get people using the thing. And so again, maybe it's just the way things used to work, the effort that used to be required to actually put something in the wild was so much higher. You needed that conviction in order to dedicate the resources, in order to, you know, put it in production. And now today it's a little different. It's just easier to put stuff in the wild. So maybe it's okay if we're half convicted. And then, you know, again, instead of looking for validation early from customers before you build it, to seek that validation from customers after you've released something that's an MVP or a V1 or, you know, kind of a pared down version of what the idea could ultimately become.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's also, if you're making a product that's in a space that already exists, you can know that there's a market that already exists. And so you can know people get value from that product. And so that's like, you can, because if you release it and it doesn't work, then like it's probably the product itself, right? And the hard part is going to be for people, all these new spaces where, hey, I have this idea of this totally new thing I can do. It's never existed before. No idea how big the market is, truly. Don't really know where it's going to go. And it's going to have to come back to like, I think, taste, which is like, do you have the right taste in what the thing that you're building? And if you send it out, it doesn't resonate. Is it actually like the wrong people or is it actually the wrong product? And I feel like this conversation is very interesting because we're basically talking about this shifting of like the limiting factors and where is the bottleneck going to move to? And then how do you manage these new bottlenecks that we haven't been had them as bottlenecks before the same way?
Yeah. And you used a really, I think, interesting word, which is taste. And it does feel like we've used the metaphor that like the creative team is becoming the editorial board for the business.
Yeah.
And, you know, as the, you know, the limiting factor used to be output or the number of ideas that you could experiment with, as that goes away, I think the role of taste, the role of that kind of editorial eye becomes even more important. And, you know, we've gotten into, you know, this whole like data training world is an interesting one. We've gotten to know some of these foundation model companies pretty well. And what you hear from them is, you know, the machines are really good at objective evaluations. Is this a beach ball? Is this a soccer ball?
Yeah.
They are not particularly good at subjective evaluations. Does this meet our brand standards?
Yeah.
Is this good enough to put in front of a customer?
Yeah.
And we hear oftentimes that like this is the bottleneck in the model development process. It's this kind of subjective human in the loop layer that is still super important. And again, you can't really automate it away. So
yeah, I tried a new product yesterday that's supposed to only make on-brand content. You like put in your
website.
That's
their promise.
That's their promise. So you put in your website, sucks in a logo, sucks in your brand colors and padding and blah, 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 trains on your shit. And then you say, make me this, make me that. And I'm playing with it. And I'm not saying the name. You can guess why. But I'm playing with it. I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like it pulled in a lot of our stuff. Doesn't look right. And it's like, and it wasn't that it doesn't look like the content was all correct. And I could talking to it like I would talk to a human. I'm like, make something about 110-100, which is like, you know, the docuseries we did a few years ago. I guess a long while ago at this point. And it makes a poster and it gets it right. It says like 110-100 into thirds. And on the one, it says 1K and it shows like one person, scrappy setup. It does the stuff. Like it understands conceptual, but it just doesn't look right. I'm like, we could not release this. Like it just, and so it's funny because on paper, it did all the stuff it said it was going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I was like, this would not fly. Like, I think people would just think it's off. And that is a very, not many people have sat in the seat of doing that job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I think is interesting is like, not many people have been the editorial board. Not many people have been the arbiter of taste. But guess what? It's going to be a lot more people who have to do that, or we have to change our processes to make that more rapid or more blunt or something, because that has become much more important.
Yeah, I think the editorial board is actually like a very apt metaphor. And I think like the thing that I keep seeing is, so because the limiting factor of like shipping is no longer, right? Because you can create 10 ideas instead, or you can follow through on 10 projects from one idea instead of, you know, one project from one idea. Who are the people who are saying, okay, this project out of those 10, I feel like I'm getting all my numbers mixed up, but out of this 10, which is the project that we're really gonna run with? Like, cool, you made 10, 9 of them suck.
Right.
Who's that person? I'm asking, who's the person?
I mean, I think like, so I think the most important thing is to have an answer. And I think who that person is can, you know, depend on the organization. You know, we have a creative director who's, right, like the head of the editorial board. You know, obviously, if you're a CEO founder, like you probably have opinions there as well. But, and I guess I go back to, you know, the role of vision and having to be like a little bit more concrete than we have traditionally. And I think if you have laid down something that like the team feels like it can touch, it's not like too abstract, then the role of, you know, the head of the editorial board is a little bit more straightforward.
Nailed it.
It's a tricky one. And like, there's this, you know, when I think about product, like normally, you know, hey, we're evaluating, you know, the opportunity, we're talking to customers, come up with some ideas, you kind of reverse sort on impact and you're like, great, do that thing first. But now we've also got this extra variable, which is again, like how wide is the gap between the promise of the technology and the present reality of the technology that you kind of have to overlay. So we find ourselves actually skipping some of the bigger ideas in the short run because we're like, like we could do it. But to your point, Chris, like it doesn't feel like 80% is good enough for this particular feature. So like, let's sit on it and come back when we're closer to 95% or, you know, wherever you decide to draw the line.
Yeah, that seems like the big challenge here. Is like which of those projects, which of those things that you want to, you kind of said it earlier, like you would want to start on it now because, like, let's say it's very AI enabled. The AI is close to delivering something great, so you want to explore it now. You want to play with it now. It's not going to be 100% for sure, so you know it's subpar, but you need feedback. And those types of decisions become really hard. Because from an editorial perspective, taste-wise, you might be like, it's not there.
Yeah.
But I think based on this, the trend of this technology, it will be there. And it might be there actually really quick. So, man, if I wait till it's there, I'm now late.
Yep.
And yeah, it's so much more about editorial. And it's, I think it's also about, like, who are the customers that I actually know that I can serve really, really well. And I should keep serving them really well for a long term. And if you get that right, it also makes it easier because there's certain, you know, you can understand like, hey, my customer has these 10 things I can help them with, but this one or two, we're going to deliver really great right now. Yep. So I'm going to go make that happen and like make it really amazing and then knock it down. But it does seem like it is much more of this editorial focus.
Do you?
And much more taste-based, I think.
Yeah. Do you find your customers show you more grace in like this current moment?
Some do. I think it's a mix. I think we have some customers who I can't believe the stuff they're asking for because it's so bleeding edge. And they're like, I can't believe, like, why don't you have this thing yet? Like, this is crazy. And then I know if we had that in there, that we'd have a ton of customers be like, you cannot, no, like, I don't want this. Don't turn it on, you know? Yeah. So it is this spectrum that has to change how you think about building product. I mean, today, the day that this episode comes out, we're doing a webinar, my co-founder and I, this like founder demo, and we're teasing out this new product that we've built. And it is very much not done. It is very much something that we really want people to push it with us and help us understand what it's capable of. And so we're doing something very differently than we've done in the past, which is we're doing a webinar at 11 a.m. Eastern, I think. So if you're listening to this the day it came out, maybe in like an hour, we're going to show them, hey, this is the product. This is what it does. These are the uses we've found for it that we think are really cool. And then we're going to launch it as a private beta. So only people who come to this event and get in there and say, hey, I'm willing to try this thing that is very much undone, but we think has like cool potential, are going to try it. And then we're going to bring them into a private Slack group inside the Wistia Slack, so we can actually kind of co-create with them. And this is our solution, is this is something that I think if we had no Wistia, we would have launched.
Yeah.
But we have a Wistia. And a lot of customers would be like, this is not, I don't, this doesn't work for me. But I know from my own experiences, there are certain things that it does deliver. So it's changing totally how we're releasing stuff, basically, is the point.
Yeah, so fun. And yeah, we've like, I think experienced the same thing. Like we were in Nashville, as I mentioned, and had a customer in, and we were talking about same sort of thing. Like we're like, hey, here's the stuff that's coming. Like, how does this sound to you? Are you using anything like this today? And the response was, can you like give it to me now so I can play with it? I'll give you feedback. Like there are definitely, again, this whole excitement, uncertainty continuum. There are definitely pockets of customers to your point who like want to climb in with you, help you push the thing forward again, because I think they can see the promise and want to help you get there, which I think is, it does feel cool and different. So that's really neat that y'all are changing up the way you think about releasing products.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we made something at a hackathon. We're like, oh my God, this thing is awesome. It's kind of exactly what we're talking about. Like it happened very rapidly. Then we're like, okay, from a taste perspective and understanding, we're like, we think this could be very, very cool, but also it's not there yet, but it relies on a lot of different AI models. As the models get better, this thing will just inherently get better. So we have to, it's like exactly what we're talking about. And it's just very, it reminds me of something we would have done. We did do when we were like 20, 30 people and it was the norm. So TJ, this has been awesome. Do you have anything else? I feel like you're about to say something else.
No, I had a blast. This was great. Less walking than the last time we caught up, but this works too.
Cool. We loved having you on the show. Where can people connect with you to learn more about Storyblocks, but also learn more about and connect with you?
Yeah. So easiest place to find Storyblocks is storyblocks.com. You can play around with our new AI toolkit, all the content spelled just as it sounds, or that is on my t-shirt. And then for me, probably the easiest place is on LinkedIn. I try and pay attention there. So reach out, very friendly, and love hearing from folks, whether they're customers or people who are following the space, have opinions about tools. I spend a fair bit of my time. This has been one of the fun parts of the last couple of years. I have Tinker time blocked off in my calendar. And so, you know, we'll have Tinker explorations on there sometimes. So yeah, those are probably the best two places to track me down.
Awesome.
Tinker time.
Yeah,
Tinker time. I love it. It's Tinker time.
All the time now. Well, thank you very much for having me on. This was a ton of fun. Thanks, Sylvie. Thanks, Grace. Good to see you both.
Good to see you, man.
Anytime someone says tinker, which I guess isn't that often, or maybe it is, I don't know, but I always want to go Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
I literally almost said the same thing. I was going to do it. I should have done it. I thought you were going to say Tinker Tailor. This is what happens. You know, you get so close. You're just like, follow the instincts all the way in. And you're like, no, I don't want to plow over Sylvie. No, I don't want to ruin this. And then I ruined it by not doing it. But yes, Tinker Tailor.
If we had done it, if we had jinxed on that, podcast of the year, right there.
I was going to say, that episode would have gone viral just because of that moment 40 minutes in. So, but honestly, great conversation. It was super fun talking with TJ about really the implications of AI, how it's changing where the bottlenecks are, how you have to think about building products, content, this idea of being more open to change in general and searching for things and everything feeling early stage. So yeah, it was good vibes to talk through all that. I hope it was useful to everybody who was here with us watching and listening. And that is it for this week's episode. So if you want to see some behind the scene moments, follow Talking Too Loud on Instagram and TikTok. There's lots of stuff dropping there all the time. Things that I'm constantly telling them, don't release this. This is too crazy. But they do it anyway. And if you're listening to this episode and decide you do want to watch it because you're very curious about our video setups, you can find us on YouTube. And if you want to stay even more connected with us, subscribe to Talking Too Loud on Wistia.
Deuces. Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubow, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.